Hey everybody, it is time. It is time to hop on a plane, a train, a boat, a goat, a bike, a car, and find your way upstate New York to a little town outside of Phoenicia. I don't know what the town's called actually, but the place that we're going to be in is called Menla, and it is a gorgeous, epic retreat center in the middle of the forest in the Catskill Mountains with a spa and organic vegetarian food with lots of beans and yoga in the morning and a swimming pool and a swimming hole and trails. And yes, it is an HLN retreat. It is a 5-day retreat from Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. It is the biggest retreat we've ever put on, and the entire team is going to be there. They are all flying from different corners of the country to come together to hold you in the healing magic that is Somatics. We will be teaching you how to belong without having to fit in, how to find safety inside of yourself and share that with others, how to receive witnessing, how to feel for your boundaries instead of fawning. We are going to cover so much, and you're going to be doing it in the most ideal setting of being fed, of being loved, of resting, of enjoying the forest and nature, and being with us and 60 other bodies. So please go to the website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click on events, and you'll find it there. Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. All the info as well can be found directly through the link in this episode details. I am just so thrilled for this, and I can't wait to see some of you in person. Today I speak with a woman who, through her own pain and suffering around racial trauma, has discovered a way of life to embody and heal and help others.
I heard my grandmother's asking me, you know, asking, I got pulled into it, saying, when you heal yourself, you'll be healing all of us as well.
Welcome to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast. I'm your host, Luis Mojica. I was sick and depressed until I discovered that I could make music. And then my whole life transformed because I began learning how to listen more deeply. Listen to life, to the people around me, and to my body. And that's when I realized that the body speaks through sensations, and learning this new language meant relearning my body and mind. I soon healed myself of many chronic conditions and then began teaching others how to do so as well. Holistic Life Navigation combines nutrition, self-inquiry, and somatic experiencing to help you release stress and trauma just by listening to your own body. This podcast serves as a place to share my experiences, as well as the experiences of many others who have healed and are healing through unique, unorthodox, and unusual ways. Your time to learn begins now. Today's episode is a really wonderful one. I just so enjoy speaking with this woman, Carolyn. My whole life has been a series of conversations. Every job I've ever had, especially when I was unemployed, that was my most rich period for, I guess, what I would call an interview now. But just communication, just connection, right? I remember just sitting on benches in Tompkins and Washington Square Park for hours, nursing a pack of cigarettes and my little journal where I'd be writing poems and song lyrics as they came to me, and waiting for an interesting person that I could make eye contact with, and anyone that would make eye contact with me and then would come and sit next to me was someone that I knew was a friend. And I learned so much from these mysterious people who I never even knew some of their names. This was before I had a cell phone. This is before I had social media. This is before I had a business or a platform. So I never even thought to ask people, you know, what's your information? What do you do? Instead, it was just an intimacy of connection and communicating, sharing, and just learning from people's life experience. And this episode feels like that to me too, because I met Carolyn through an Instagram post. I wrote something and she responded, and something in her response was just so beautiful and familiar and very similar to how I think and feel. And I thought, I want to meet that person. So I wrote to her and I said, hey, do you want to have a phone call? Do you want to have a conversation? She said, yes. So I called her. We had a lovely phone call. Kind of felt like just a friend that I've always had. It's very easy to talk to her. And I said, would you come on my podcast and share your story and your philosophies and just how you heal and believe in healing and how you view trauma and such? And she said, absolutely. So first I wanted to just read the post. The title of my post was, You Can Try to Forget the Past Until It Shows Up in Your Body. And I write, our bodies hold the memories of our physical past experiences, both traumas and wisdoms. They also hold the memories of our ancestors. That's a lot of memory. Finding the context to those physical memories can be amazing and validating. Past life regressions, psychedelics, somatic therapies, and dream interpretations can all open up past memories. What I find helpful and relevant is to not identify with those past experiences or lifetimes, but instead identify how they are still showing up in your body through behaviors, addictions, reflexes, and trauma responses that override the authentic you, the natural you, the honest you. When we're traumatized, the body is literally stuck in the past experiences and projecting them onto the future. So no one is home, so to speak. It's just a body functioning on autopilot, survival, and fear that is out of context with its current reality. When we notice that the past is coming through our bodies, yet we can show our bodies we're in the present, we update the body to the current moment, and we lose some of the charge associated with remembered and expected threats. And then I'm looking through my replies, and I see this comment from Carolyn.
What if your present moment is continuous moments of trauma? What if the society you live in every moment has demonstrated to you that your body is never really safe? What if the color of your skin puts you at risk for emotional and physical harm in the present moments of your life, in a social structure that was designed legislatively, constitutionally, socially, to deny your full humanity and construct a national perception that you are inferior? Yes, it is violence to the full collective body. We need to acknowledge and reconcile the harm that still exists in the air that we breathe before we can move forward, healing individually and collectively. We are in the era of the reckoning, of revelations, or to reveal. It's not supposed to be warm or fuzzy. I like that you are doing the work of resourcing folks to discover the power, Louise, the power of regulation and mastery of our nervous system, finding the way home to heart mind, which is psyche, which means soul.
So I read this and I thought, wow, this is great. This is an unusual person. This is a special person. And so I wrote back, first off, I bow to you. I don't know what it's like being Black in America. I do know what it's like being assaulted and endlessly bullied because of my body. So I know that feeling in my body of waiting for the next threat and violation to occur. Your question is too nuanced to answer properly in a comment. Just know it's possible to still find safety in this world, and I'll do a video soon about it. Now, what I love about what she's about to say next is everything I wanted to say but didn't. Carolyn writes,
"Thank you for your response, Louise. Safety must be found in the body, in the spirit, and mind. Safety does not exist in the world until each body of the collective body awakens to the light within and the light in every other human. The challenge before us is not denying the ugly, messy, uncomfortable stuff, but in acknowledging that it exists, our responsibility and our role in it, as well as awakening to our true nature as whole in the whole. I'm learning how to feel safe in my body enough to live an embodied life, mastering my nervous system and regulating the energies moving through my body in a world that feels unsafe."
So when I read that, the part that really hit me was safety must be found in the body. Safety does not exist, quote, in the world. That's a powerful and honest statement that I teach in my courses and I teach in my private practice with individuals and in the group therapies I do. Because sometimes it doesn't make a lot of sense just to say it. You have to really learn it and experience it. But it couldn't be any more honest or any more true. To say there's safety in the world or to say there's danger in the world, both are true, but neither is predictable. We don't know ever. So to affirm or convince ourselves that there is safety or that we know, it's not going to get us very far. It's going to piss a lot of people off because you're going to end up denying the suffering of others. The one thing we all can be very sure of, however, is the safety in our own bodies or the danger in our own bodies. Is my body feeling safe and expanded? Does it have the capacity to integrate and actually experience conflict, discomfort, potential threat? Because we know those are inevitable, right? Does it have the capacity to experience the safety when I do find it? The connection, the intimacy, the vulnerability. What does my body have the capacity to do, to experience, to connect, to take in? The only thing each and every one of us is 100% responsible for are our bodies, no one else's, are our minds, no one else's. The sooner we stick with our own bodies and our own minds, the more energy we spend being self-aware, and the more energy we spend healing the parts of us that are hurt and aching and feeling disembodied or feeling broken. Carolyn says something in the interview like, "Well, everyone's whole, just not everyone knows it." And I love it. I couldn't agree with that more. So I leave you with that exchange we had and these concepts, because these were the fertile, you know, seeds that we were sowing digitally that turned into a really lovely private conversation that then turned into this interview. So I welcome you to this episode, and I hope you find it useful. So I would like to welcome Carolyn Carter to the show today. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Louise, for having me.
I think that when we were having our exchange, I was so inspired when you said safety doesn't exist in the world until each body essentially can feel safe. And then you were saying for yourself, your work is you create safety in your body to then go into a world, whether that world be safe or unsafe. The point is, if your body's centered and safe, then you have your sense of self, you have your spirit, right? Mm-hmm. And that just inspired me to reach out to you and learn who you are, you know, what you do, what your story is, because it's so in line with how I live. And I'd love to know how you got there. So I think my first question is simply, You know, how do you want to tell your story? What's your story that led you to the work that you do and the way you live?
Oh, that's a question, huh? What's my story? I think we have so many stories, depending on the cycle of our lives. So if I had to start at what my story is at the beginning and the theme maybe that runs across my life that I've discovered is that it's the unconventional. And the it's sort of the theme throughout my life. So I am biracial. I am an identical twin. I am an army brat, among other things. I'm a mother, a grandmother, a wife. We are such beautifully complex beings. And it's so we try to encapsulate ourselves sometimes in these stories about who we are. And that's a beautiful thing that we can craft our stories and we can frame our own stories. And having the autonomy and agency to do that is such a critical part of being in the world and being able to be home with ourselves in these times. So I would say the unconventional, and I don't know if it was designed for me to come into the world in this unconventional body, body and in this social construct where everything about me, it seems, is unconventional and not in the frame of what we say is normal. So that has led me to live a life where I had to not necessarily see myself in other people. Like, when we live in communities and we may have similar cultures, we may have similar ways that we look, we may have similar family constructs. Well, all those things were not familiar in the world that I was perceiving through the eyes and through my senses. And so I always felt like, something was wrong with me. I was not right. I was not enough. Something had to change. Mm-hmm. My hair didn't look like my mom's hair. She's Korean, Asian, and her hair is straight. And, and my father was African-American. He is deceased. He has passed on transition. And a very dark, handsome man, West African roots. And I sort of didn't see myself in the world around me. And so it sort of led to this sort of crisis of identity. Like, who are you really? I mean, you don't look like your mother, really. You don't look like your father. You don't look like any of these people around you. You don't even sound like any of these people around you, because you've traveled all over. You've lived in so many different places. And so now you're back here in New Orleans and you don't sound like any of these people that you're going to school with, right? You don't look like them. You don't have the same beliefs or values that they, you don't have those things shared. You don't eat the same foods, you may not dress the same. So, even though these things aren't necessarily important in of themselves, they contribute to a part of our identity, of our perceived story, of our perceived narrative. And so that narrative and that story of how we see ourselves, how we sense the world around us, has everything to do with how we relate to ourselves first and then to others and to the world and to nature and the cosmos. And so everything starts with our relationship with self, our self-image, our self-worth, our sense of autonomy, our sense of agency, our sense of belonging.
I'm just sitting back and really feeling you and your story because it's so relatable. And I think part of why I wanted to speak with you and when we were kind of speaking about it before the interview was the gift of growing up without identity. There it's such a blessing and a curse when you're growing up because right, like you were putting it, I don't know if you've heard of the psychologist Esther Perel. Are you familiar with any of her work?
No.
She has this one great statement she makes a lot about identity and ego. And she essentially says it's how we organize our reality. It's like mm-hmm. the story we tell ourselves just to organize reality. We know as spiritual people, when you're, you know, beyond that, there is no reality. Like everything's just all over the place. But as humans, mm-hmm. like you said, to mm-hmm. navigate the world, you organize things to literally survive in the physical plane, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you're growing up without that identity, your ego is constantly being broken down because you don't have a self to rely on, a story to rely on. It's always mm-hmm. shifting, isn't it?
Yes. And
so I'm curious, how did you find it in yourself to remain intact, to stay connected when identity wasn't something that was solid for you?
It's been a very painful journey. And I'm just now allowing myself to feel the pain of it to acknowledge the shame in some of the things that I have felt. And I'll share that because it may be some things that other people may be feeling. So I never really thought about race and identity until until my father retired from the military and we moved back to the States. We moved to New Orleans and I was in culture shock. So when you're in the military, you're around people from all over the world, biracial families are not, extraordinary, mm-hmm. And so you don't really live in that world, so to speak. I guess it was maybe because of my youth and age, and again, because of every 3 years we were moving to a different country or state or whatever, mm-hmm. where all my siblings are from different places. So I think that because of that, when I came here and everybody was thinking, would ask, what are you? What are mm-hmm. you? Are you, where are you from? Are you Black? No, you're not Black. Are you Asian? No, you're not Asian. Are you this? No, you're not that. So, some people want to tell you this, some people want to tell you that. Mm-hmm. And then you're thinking like, does it really matter? I mean, why is everybody asking? Is that your hair? Is that your real hair? just weird. Like, who am I really? Everybody thinks like, I'm a Martian. Like, this is where real hair is.
You're like a walking myth to people. I know that feeling. Yeah, it's so interesting.
Yeah. So I felt like ashamed, like when I was in, so I went to schools, Catholic schools that were predominantly white. Mm. And I went to schools that were predominantly Black. And what I realized is that when I was at school that were predominantly white, I sort of adopted their ways and saw myself the way they saw me or saw themselves. So you could say I sort of didn't really like myself because I saw all of these people in white bodies that were beautiful. And everywhere I saw, everything beautiful was in white bodies and flesh tone was the color white. And, the hair was silk and straight and your nose was thin and not flared. And, so everybody around me was this perception of beauty and I didn't feel it. So in order to feel that sense of primal belonging in that community of white bodies, I began to see myself in that way. And I started to try and identify as white. I started to talk like them. I started to not like people that looked like me, sort of have be ashamed of it, mm-hmm. And then on my mother's, she's Asian. And so in our community, when the Vietnamese refugees came from Vietnam after the war, and made communities here in our community, you know, people had this thing about Asians, you know? So now it's like, well, I'm Asian, and so people hate these Asian people, and I look like, my eyes look like that, and so I became ashamed of my mother. Mm-hmm. I didn't want her to come to school because I didn't want people to see that, you know, that's what I was. So there was all this shame and disowning parts of myself that was very painful, living outside of my body and other people's minds and other people's hearts and other people's approval and validation. Mm. I was living outside of myself for so long and looking for validation and my own being in the eyes and the hearts of other people who were just as lost as I was. I just did not know it.
See, that's really powerful right there, because there's this term I picked up when I was studying called projective identity. Mm-hmm. And it's this way that we identify ourselves based on how other people see us or treat us. Mm-hmm. And what's so poignant about what you just said, and very true in my experience as well, is the way that the way those people are seeing you, their perception is just as distorted as your perception. Mm-hmm. So we have this culture, this society of distorted perceptions trying to identify one another and themselves.
Yeah.
And everyone's falling short. You know, and it's amazing to me how long we can live, like when you said, how long you can live outside of yourself, trying to maintain a concept of who you are just by, okay, which people are surviving the best, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to be like them. Mm-hmm. And I just find that so like, that's the trauma, isn't it? You know, like when mm-hmm. we disconnect from ourselves and think a part of ourselves is just wrong or unworthy.
Yeah. It is part of the social constructs that are created for us and that we have sort of, you know, adapted into our lives, and without question most of the time. It's just the way it is, you know. Mm-hmm. Parents says so, you know, the church says so, the government says so. And even though it doesn't feel right in our bodies, and I knew since a child that certain religious beliefs didn't feel right in my body, that certain things that adults said to me did not feel right in my body, but they are served to us as the wise ones, the knowers, you know, mm-hmm. the authority. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to really think about what those things mean and what does it mean to us and what is a social construct? What is a community, and what is the biofield of that community? Mm. We all are contributing some of our energies into this biofield of a community that we all live in. It's the air that we breathe. And so when we live in a social construct that lifts up domination and dominance and superiority of people in certain bodies, you know, in the United States and European, it's people and bodies that are labeled white. And race is really a man-made construct. Mm-hmm. We have our nations of origin. We have our ancestral, lineages. We have places that where we belong to the land. And we are so disconnected from the earth. We're so disconnected from the cosmos. We are so disconnected from each other. We are disconnected from ourselves. And until we can really learn how to reignite that connection back to ourselves, we will be disconnected.
I appreciate what you're saying too about the, like, mm-hmm. I love when you say the lands that we belong to. I mm-hmm. think what's so gorgeous about culture, and I use the word culture or ethnicity over race because I'm trying to unlearn just the concept of race I was born into, just like you were. Culture points you to a land, you know, like race points you to a concept. There's no mm-hmm. race on earth, really. It's a concept. But culture points you to a land. And when you said what you were saying about white bodies being mm-hmm. the standard, right? For beauty, success, norm, whatever you want to call it. The term white is also an assault on people who identify as white because they've also lost their originations and their ancestral cultures and the herbs and the dances and the foods and the languages which they blossomed from. No one was born white. We were all born from a land and then someone decided to call it white based on skin tone. Mm-hmm. And so I say that because I too went to Catholic school and my experience was much more based in gender. And I was born with an intersexual expression. So mm-hmm. I made all this estrogen. So as I was developing, I started developing hips and breasts. And so when I was going through that very, you know, vulnerable process of developing as everyone does, mm-hmm. the boys were noticing that I was not a normal boy. And the girls were noticing that I wasn't a normal boy. So I come from as well from a biracial family, but because we're more white cast than you know, like we're Puerto Rican and Irish, that we have white skin, so we pass as white, but I didn't pass as male, you know. So I had this similar experience of my body showing people that I didn't fit in one place or another, and then eventually hating my body and hating everything feminine, right? And trying to just like cut that part of me out. And for me, I remember one day suddenly feeling safe in my body for the first time after years of being disembodied and trying to establish myself as the norm. Where was that moment for you where suddenly you felt like, no, this body is beautiful. I can be in this body. It's safe. Well, how did that happen for you?
So I think it was a gradual sort of, I'm going to use the word blooming into it. Because of the pain and agony of not being able to be in a healthy relationship. I've been married for 40 years. I was pregnant at the age of 17, gave birth to my first child at 18, married at 18, and I'm still married. It's been 40 years. And so it was a very volatile relationship at first because there was a codependency that was deeply rooted in our traumas. Mm. And we hurt each other a lot. And you sort of see each other. The codependency is that you think you need, or you feel that you need that empty place. You think that you can get it from that person. And that's not their job, is to make you whole. Mm. No one can make me whole. I couldn't make him whole and he couldn't make me whole.
Right.
You know, and so when we get into these relationships where we're trying to find our wholeness in another person that isn't whole yet. I mean, they're whole, but they haven't recognized their wholeness. Let me just say it that way.
Beautiful. Mm.
And so it's this constant dance of conflict because no one can awaken us to our homes. Mm-hmm. And so after just being, you know, the whole issue of being in a very painful relationship and trying to find myself, I just feel that I just gradually, the pain sort of awakened a place in me. The suffering awakened the place in me. The isolation and the abandonment awakened a place in me. And the darkness became a sanctuary where I started to recognize that there in the darkness is where I awakened to the fact that I was the light. And so I feel that in the world today, we are blooming into knowing that we are awakening in this darkness, and these times feel like darkness, don't they? You know, where we have to meet our grief so much, so forcefully, you know, and we're like, why so much grief? There's grief and suffering and death and all that all around us. And we're in this isolation where we can't even touch or be with each other in times that, you know, we should be grieving together. And so the question is, what is this about? What is this reckoning really about? Why are we in this space of feeling so isolated in times where we're all grieving and we need to feel connected? And so what I realized, it is sort of like how I awaken to, this is who I am. And you know what? Screw it. This is who I am and be who I am. You know, I think that now we are being invited. It's an invitation back home to ourselves. It is a merciful, merciful act of mercy of the divine. It says, here, you are not the darkness. You are the light in the darkness. And when we think about the concept of Christ, we think of the Christ, meaning he is the anointed one. He is the, or she, or whatever, you know, I don't want to get into gender, but the Christ is the anointed one. The Christ is the deliverer. The Christ is the savior. And what does that mean? It's that it is the light that illuminates within us to show us that it is there. We are that light. The Christ is in us, and the Christ is in every person we lay our eyes upon. But we haven't awakened to that yet. And I think that the world and the divine wants to give us this invitation to come back home. And sometimes we do that in our darkness, if we accept that invitation.
Yeah, I feel very full from all that. It's so beautiful because when you were saying the piece about in the isolation, you know, in the darkness, in feeling disconnected, in there you found your sanctuary. That's my exact experience. And when I have held space for other people as they go through their transformations, that's their experience. And when this pandemic started happening and I was watching so many global events take place that were so culturally and collectively traumatizing, yet, like you pointed out, we can't physically be together. It's such an amazing pause to have to feel and be with yourself, isn't it? And I love what you said about Christ, because I actually have a painting on a piece of wood of Jesus in my office with a picture of him pointing his hand into his heart with all this light coming out.
Yeah.
Always loved that image because there's two ways to see it. There's the way that it's been, you know, proselytized as in follow this person. And then the way you just said that, that person's actually saying it's in you. Not necessarily saying follow me. It's saying this thing I'm pointing to, you have it as well, right?
Yeah.
And so this is an opportunity to even get closer to that. Now, this is where it gets tricky for people with trauma. When your darkness becomes your sanctuary, which I love that concept. And I think of nature, I think of seeds in the dark earth, I think of the caterpillars, I think of so much darkness that needs to happen for transformation and isolation. There's this fine line between how do I stay embodied to like birth the transformation, which is terrifying and triggering and painful, versus how do I not get dissociated, become addicted, distract myself from it. So I don't expect an answer necessarily, but I'm curious, how do you currently practice or teach that kind of embodiment where you stay present and feel safe as you hit that ridge of discomfort within yourself? What's your experience around that?
Well, the way I explained it to someone years ago, I did work in racial reconciliation, racial healing. And I learned a lot from the very courageous people with this project I did with Mayor Mitch Landrieu and his administration. And I found it very courageous that, and I worked with a very courageous woman, African-American woman, Judy Reese Morse, who really taught me so much about what's possible. And so we never thought we would see this kind of work in that space, right? You know, in a space where there's politics and governance. But it was her heart that really opened that concept up to me. So what I learned is that it is in our conflict that it becomes a portal home to ourselves. It is an invitation home. We are so afraid of conflict. And so when we would have these healing circles about race, you know, and everybody is like, it is a traumatic subject. There's trauma in our bodies. We are highly charged. So when I look back at these highly charged people, you know, with this trauma in their bodies, talking about a highly charged topic without the resourcing needed, you know, to have these conversations in ways that were maybe more fruitful. It was helpful, but at the same time, people are afraid of their emotions. They're afraid of feeling. They're afraid of conflict, and they see it as something to be avoided. Mm-hmm. And so we live in this construct that is trying to avoid conflict. We're trying to avoid feeling. We're trying to avoid discomfort. All these, the darkness has been portrayed as something bad, something, you know, taboo. And also conflict has been, you know, constructed as something bad, something taboo. You want to stay away from that. You know, and the failure, bad, taboo, stay away from all these things that we have been conditioned to believe are bad are really our way to find ourselves. Failure is not failure. Conflict is not conflict the way we perceive it. Nope. Darkness is not darkness the way this construct perceives it. All these things root us in fear. And what fear does is it feeds the external false powers and authorities, and it usurps our own authority. So, you know, fear feeds the ego and the external powers.
And all these constructs were born from ego to begin with. So,
we continue to feed it. We have to unravel. That's what I call it, unraveling. I've been feeling like I've been unraveling for the last, I don't know, 10 years.
Good for you. Yeah.
And so this unraveling at first is scary, but then it's like, oh, I kind of like it, you know?
I have to pause you there because I think it's just so important what you're saying. When I think somatically, the word conflict, and you're talking about the charge, there is a massive charge in conflict, isn't there? And I've come to understand charge as your life force. So when you say to me about the conflict is the portal, the discomfort is the portal, I agree it is the portal because it is your life force. It's a part of you that comes online. And we're so used to, as you said, in our society, we've developed and conditioned ourselves out of feeling that life force, being numb or being neutral or being in denial or avoidance, like you said. Right. So when this like high sensation of charge comes through, we do everything we can to deny it, or we get aggressive, or we fawn, or the performative allyship takes over. You say what people want you to say just so they feel like you're not racist. All these things come up where it's so important to know I have to actually feel the conflict in me and hold space for that first, don't we?
Yes. It's so important for us to learn how to do that again. And as you mentioned, trauma is real. It's real in each one of us. Our whole social construct is rooted in trauma. When something is rooted in trauma, we have to look at the foundation of it. The roots of it that's where the fruit comes from. So you can't have good fruit if the roots are not good. So we have to look at the roots of our social construct and say, can we come to terms with that the foundation is something maybe that doesn't honor any of us, honor us. It doesn't honor our mortality or our immortality. And so we have to really, each one of us, be bold enough to really challenge what belief is. What is belief? And where did it come from? And how do I know that it's my truth?
Mm.
So I think belief comes from, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm a wordy. I love words and I love to go me look too. At the etymology of words, because I think we get so loose with words. You know, we just use it and it becomes this thingy, you know, and then we don't even feel what it, we don't even feel the words anymore. We just say it because we're so used to saying it, just flies off our, you know, off our tongue. And so belief is to be love, what you love, what's in your heart. So if you hold these values and beliefs and you love them, and it's what you hold in your heart, in your mind heart, because I don't think the mind and the heart are separate. Mind heart is the soul. It is the psyche. And so you have to engage both. They're not, they're interdependent. So the mind heart holds these things and loves them. And so what we love, this is where your heart is, so is your treasure, right?
That's right.
What is our treasure? What are we loving? Oh, are we loving the thing, the very thing that is, you know, is poisoning us, or is poisoning our minds, poisoning our existence, poisoning our families? How are these beliefs playing out in our lives, in our communities, in our families? Generation after generation, these beliefs that we hold on to so closely, you know, become sort of the deity. And we have to have that, you know, we don't understand it. And we know it doesn't feel good. But we protect it and preserve it with everything that we have.
Well, that's part of, to bring back what you were sharing about your experience growing up. Like when you say it doesn't feel good, if we're disembodied, we don't even know it doesn't feel good. And when we're desperate for identity, this is where I experience belief coming in. When you're desperate for identity, you look at the mass hypnosis of belief. What are people in my culture believing? I'm just like you believe there's something wrong with your heritage, right? It's like we attach to the popular belief for survival. It's a trauma response, in my opinion. And so when you talk about that, what is it that you are loving? Like belief be loving? It's like we are unconsciously and in a disembodied way, we are making love to things that hurt us and others. And there's an innocence in there. There's like a sleepwalking. And I think once you get embodied, that's why I love embodiment even more than mental understanding. When you're embodied, you can't deny how something feels anymore. So as the words leave your mouth and as the thoughts enter your body, you feel when they do this to you and you constrict and when it hurts, or you feel when it opens. And I find that that really true form of love and spirit is always expansive. You can't think a thought that hurts somebody and expand. It's always going to constrict you.
Right.
And that's like the truth teller, isn't it? So when you say this unravel, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. No. Our body doesn't lie. The body doesn't lie.
Correct. And that's why I find somatic abolitionist work to be so powerful. Just like, and when we hear the term abolitionist, it can be race, it can be gender, it can be class, it can be sex. When you somatically align yourself with something you're unlearning, let's say, once you know it, you can't unknow it. And then once you unlearn it and you feel the freedom from it, you can't deny its pain in your society or in your life, right?
Right.
I just find it to be really powerful.
Yeah. And I just want to add to that, because we have these constructs, let's just take race, for example. And in our nation, you know, place where we live, it has become a thing, you know, it was created and it is a thing that has to be addressed. I don't want to make it seem like it's not a thing and race doesn't exist. And so we should not address the issue, because race is an issue. it was constructed, it was assigned a certain, you know, certain properties, it was assigned certain energies. And what it did was it took agency, autonomy, and belonging from human beings. It took that. And generational racial trauma, historical racial trauma has to be talked about in plain language. We can no longer dance around the issue of racial injustice and how the issue of race affects each and every single one of us. White bodies, brown bodies, black bodies, you know, all bodies, okay? Yep. It affects us all, because you cannot have a community or a construct, a social construct, where you have this ideology that there is one being that is more supreme than the other being, mm-hmm. and not feel that that is going to violate you, the person who said that you have dominion or you have superiority, and the person who you have deemed inferior. It's a sin against the whole community. Mm-hmm. And I've read once where the word sin in the Hebrew, and I love the Hebrew language and learning more about it, it is aligned to the word arrogance. And I found that very interesting.
I love that, because sin in Spanish, it means without. And so just both of those, like one culture says arrogance, one culture says without. They're both, if you feel those words in your body, right?
Yes.
You can feel that. Them. Yeah.
So we've had we have generations of people in black bodies that have been in a social construct, which is the ocean. You're in the ocean, you're breathing, the fact that you're inferior, that you have no autonomy in your body, that once your body was not even human in this place, that you don't belong anymore, that your identity, your beliefs, your culture, your rituals were all taken from you. Your children were all taken from you. Your hair, your phenotype, everything was deemed evil and ugly. And generation after generation, you have taken that into your body, that trauma.
That's the piece right there. Because when you were saying, you don't want this to come off like race doesn't exist because it's not real. Like part one, race isn't real because it was invented. Part two, race is real because generationally it's been stored in the bodies of people. So
it has. It's,
right? So the construct, which doesn't exist in nature, I think is what we're trying to say. Mm-hmm. The construct exists in the human body now. And it's like, how do we remove it from the human body? That's how we take it out of our societies, essentially, one body at a time.
Yes, and I think we have to perceive it and dip. We just have to change our perception and how we see, not just with these eyes, but with this eye. Mm. You know, how we sense, how we see, how our spiritual eyes perceive ourselves and everything around us. We are very much interconnected with each other. Everything is energy. And when you see things as energy, you understand that I cannot be me if you can't be you.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I, what I appreciate about that as well, I think the truth that any social construct, but we're speaking about race right now, the social construct of race, even though there's a concept that it will benefit one or the other, it's as toxic to both, isn't it? Because the part that believes they're better or has been told they're better or has the burden of having to stay better, that's a toxicity. To hurt another human being in your mind or in your body is killing you as well. It's like, because of that interconnection, we can't deny that my thoughts of you or my actions toward you, if they're violent, those are also hurting me on a level. And so I think bringing that together for people, mm-hmm. is so important. So it doesn't seem like, oh, well, it's not my problem. You know, I'm not brown or black. It's not my, you know, they should fight for that. It's mm-hmm. like, no, we breathe the same air. I mean, to me, I think of everything through nature. We literally breathe the same air and share the same water and land. It's like, that's mm-hmm. how intimate we all are. And right. if we know that, hating your neighbor is going to hurt you really badly. It's going to hurt your body and your mind yeah. and your soul. Yes. So it's like to clean that up inside, I think is just, that's really the work for me of somatic abolitionism around race. What has my body inherited through the lineages? And what does my yeah. society project back to me about my skin or my body, right?
And how do we reconcile that for our ancestors? And, you know, I think we realize now that our ancestors live in our bodies.
That's right.
We live in our bodies, our DNA, you know, that they're breathing with us, mm-hmm. they're walking with us. And so I felt a powerful urge to heal myself as a woman in this world, to heal myself, because I heard my grandmothers asking me, you know, I got pulled into it saying, when you heal yourself, you'll be healing all of us as well. And it was a very like poignant moment in my life a few years ago. And I wrote about it, I wrote a poem about it. And I don't know where those words came from. When I read the poem, I was like, oh my God, this is just all I saw I would say. Mm. So it was my mm-hmm. grandmother speaking through me saying, as a woman, we had all these sufferings, but we don't have to suffer that. You can change that. You can reconcile that. You can heal that in what was before and what will come to be in your ancestry and in your descendants. And so we have that power right now in this moment to reconcile that for our ancestry, whether you're in white bodies or black bodies or brown bodies. But also to take, it's a circular thing. It's a reciprocal, reciprocity. We get the wisdom of our grandparents and our ancestry, but we also can do something with it in order to benefit them as well and to benefit what's coming forward as well. So there is so much power in our being.
You know, I think we have to close, mm-hmm. but I want to close with, a little excerpt from a poem based on what you just said, just made me want to bring this one up. Because it really, when you talk about the ancestors and we speak about it as multi-ethnic people, mm-hmm. There's a real richness to that because your body is carrying many lands, you know, like mm-hmm. many tribes with it. And yeah. so I think there's such a depth of healing and awakening that can occur through that experience. And this poem is something that I think kind of speaks to that. So I'm going to read this little piece. It's from a woman named Aurora Levine Morales. And she wrote a book called Silt. And this is a piece from it that one of my colleagues read to us the other day. It was very beautiful. So it says, "We are the ancestors of whom no record has been kept. We are the trace elements in your bodies, minerals coloring your eyes, residue in your fingernails. You were not named for us. You do not know the places where our bones are, but we are in your bones. And because of us, you have relatives among the many tribes."
Mm. Wow.
Isn't that so powerful?
That is powerful and beautiful.
Mm, and true. I feel like I feel that. Mm.
I felt that.
Such a good time with you. You're so wonderful and easy to talk to. And just, you know, anyone that worked with you is lucky to receive your wisdom or even stand next to you at a grocery store. You know, I imagine like you walk with that love because you found it for yourself. And I'm sure people feel that. So I wanted to really thank you and love to, in the future, collaborate in some way, because I just love the work you're doing.
Oh, thank you. And I'm just starting to do that work. It's not all, you know, I haven't really launched it. And I am thankful to you for giving me the courage to speak about that. And now I can step forward. I feel like I've been in a liminal space. Mm-hmm. And that this podcast really gave me like the courage to move forward in it. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank you for that, because I've been, you know, holding back. And I think the ancestors are saying, it's time for you to move forward with this gift. You need to move it forward. So thank you for the energy to move my work forward.
Oh, you're so welcome. I can't wait to share you with everyone.
Thank you.
Yeah, you take really good care.
You too. Bye-bye.
For more information on Carolyn, you can call her, how about that, at 504-505-5528, or you can write her an email at metamorphosis1@bellsouth.net. She's available for these conversations around community healing, working with organizations around racialized healing and traumas, as well as diverse topics around neighborhood planning, education, justice, and equity. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. My question for you is, where do you feel the episode? Take a breath and just notice. What's your body doing right now? Sit with it. Let it speak to you. And let whatever comes up, come up. And your only job is to listen. For all the wisdom you need is right inside of you. For more information on my work, including my online courses and healing circles, please visit holisticlifenavigation.com. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook, where I share weekly philosophies and resources to help you release stress and trauma from your body so that you can live a happier life. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll see you next time.